started keeping me, getting me down.
Speaking of bringing you down, welcome back to the Roundtable. It's 13 minutes after 9 o'clock. It's a Thursday morning, and it is April Fool's Day, and your cruel April Fool's joke for the listeners at home and the panel. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue today, and it's the Roundtable panel. WAMC's Alan Shartok joins us. Good morning, sir.
Hey, hey.
Hey, that's all you got?
It's for horses.
All right, well, save the enthusiasm, and we'll see if we can keep it along here till 11 o'clock.
Just got back from the media project. Always fun.
How was that?
Well, it's me against all of them.
Yeah, and they win, right?
Well, I think they think so.
Also joining us on the panel today, Cohoes City Director of Operations, Teresa Bourgeois. Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning. Good morning. What a treat to be on with you. Great to hear your lovely, happy voice.
I'm very pleased. I got the call late this morning, and, you know, I didn't have time to get grumpy about it, so here we are. Hey, how are things going with the gig in Cohoes? Anybody making swords or anything over there?
Stop that.
No?
Stop that.
It's going well?
It's all going well. It's all going well. We're, you know, spring cleanups, getting ready to apply for all this infrastructure funding. It's all good. It's all good.
Good, and you're foreshadowing our first topic, so hang in there a minute. Publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman, Ira Fussfeld. Hello there, Ira.
Ray, it's been a long time. How are you doing? Hello, everybody. And Ray, I think you'll agree with me. Today is a very big day, opening day. Even those of us who don't follow sports as closely as we once did get excited about the prospect of opening day.
Oh, my gosh.
And the Mets, your Mets got their man, so it could be an interesting season.
I was in such a great mood until 6:57 when I found out I was hosting the show. Yeah, baseball is coming, and it's exciting, although I think there'll be a lot of rainouts today. Also joining us, counterterrorism expert, best-selling author, Malcolm Nance. Welcome, sir.
Ray, this is a real treat. I mean, let me guess. In 5 minutes, Joe's going to come on. That's the April Fool joke.
Well, you know, you and I both wish that was the case, but alas, that is not going to happen today. By the way, I know you're a best-selling author. Was your book advance as much as Governor Cuomo's?
Did you get $4 million?
No.
No. My last deal was about a quarter of that, though.
But you sold more books, though, right?
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
Good for you.
Well, as I don't think he ever broke 100,000.
Well, as we get... Go ahead, Alan.
I'm impressed. A quarter of $4 million. Your advance for the last book was $1 million, Malcolm? That's congratulations. I got to ask you for a loan.
That's cheating. That's two books, but it includes my memoir, which will be coming out next year.
Now, reminder, Malcolm, the WAMC lockbox is open, so feel free to...
I've been shoveling money into
all
that
right,
thing.
Man. I know you have. By the way, as we get going with the panel, if you're listening at home and there's probably three people left, you can email us at panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. Keep the letters brief. You know the rules. On topic. No attachments. No abbreviations. Give it a proofread before you hit send. panel@wamc.org. President Biden announced a huge infrastructure plan to win the future. President Biden has outlined a $2.3 trillion plan to re-engineer the nation's infrastructure over the next 8 years. He's billing it as a once-in-a-generation investment in America that'll help the U.S. compete with China, create millions of jobs, promote tax fairness, and still not balloon the national debt. Some Republicans, okay, all Republicans, are skeptical that this will happen without huge tax increases. And in fact, there are some tax proposals included with this, and we'll get to that. First, let's go to WAMC's Alan Shartok. What do you make of this proposal?
Well, I think it's terrific. Look, you know, the Republican, remember, he was a Republican. General Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, came up with the interstate highway system. That is beginning to crumble, as are roads all around the place. In our little Great Barrington, we have several, that's more than one, bridges that are down and don't seem to be repaired. We hear from the plaintive wails from the selectmen here in our little town that they're going to get around to it. But in the meantime, they haven't done it. So if our little town is representative of what is going on in the rest of the country, we need this, and we need it bad.
The proposal includes $115 billion to modernize bridges, highways, and roads that are in the worst shape, $85 billion for public transit. That doubles the federal government's commitment to repair and expand service. Also, $80 billion to modernize Amtrak's Northeast Corridor. And I have not been on that particular run in a long time, but I assume, Malcolm, you have been on that train. It needs a little work, right?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, once you go past Washington, D.C., are you aware that Amtrak trains are the lowest priority? They will literally stop a train for 10, 15, 30 minutes, an hour for freight trains to go by. And if they can do that, if they can really expand and bring us into at least the 20th century, that would be pretty good. But the 21st century with high-speed rail, man, that's a lot of jobs.
I remember, Malcolm, when that used to happen on the New York to Hudson run, and we used to be sidetracked. Somehow they fixed that up, so it's not quite as bad as it once was, but it was terrible. Sometimes you'd wait an hour, you're right about that. You're certainly right.
Teresa Bourgeois, you mentioned at the outset here that you are already planning what to do with the infrastructure funds. What sort of a guidance have you had? What sort of pre-word on how much you'll be getting have you gotten?
Well, you don't know how much you're getting, but you're looking at what the potential sources of funding are. And so we are, you know, we have $18 million in, you know, need for $18 million in our water treatment plant upgrades. Here's an example. We had a sinkhole about a week ago. And when you open up the sinkhole and you look down there, our city engineer points to the photo and says, this is an 1895 pipe that broke.
1895.
A pipe that was put in there in 1895.
Made out of?
Clay.
Made out of clay?
Yeah, clay pipe.
Interesting.
So we have not all of our infrastructure. I mean, we're a historic city, and not all of our infrastructure is that old, but some of it is that old. And so whether you're talking about water infrastructure, water and sewer, wastewater treatment, you know, what goes into the rivers, there's a whole program called stormwater improvement, so you handle water better so you don't have pollution in your rivers, your roads, your, you know, lights, switching lights to LED so you have energy savings. So we're doing energy audits on all of our buildings, so that we know what improvements need to be made. We're doing streetscape designs, all of these things to get ready to be able to apply for and receive and spend these fundings. And, you know, just as Alan says, just in our community, there are millions and millions of dollars in necessary infrastructure that we could spend just in our community. And so this is extremely welcome news. And what it does is it will not only improve the infrastructure, but it will put people back to work, and then it will circulate money within the economy, because if you have construction workers, they're going to the local stewards to buy coffee, you know, they're going to the grocery stores, some people are stopping at the restaurants to pick up a slice of pizza. So not only does it improve the infrastructure, it circulates money through our community's economy, and therefore lifts up all of our economy.
But, I want to put a big but in here. Yeah,
okay,
well,
right.
I'm not you.
Make your own joke there. All right,
go ahead.
No, Ray and I were thinking along the same
line. Go ahead, sir.
We don't know that this thing is going to pass. It'll certainly pass in the House of Representatives, and it better before the Democrats lose it, if they lose it. But but on the other hand, the Senate is by no means a sure thing. We got Manchin and some of these other people who may not vote for it. And so it's going to be a tough road to hoe for Chuck Schumer and his colleagues to get it through there.
You know, I know you guys have talked about this with regard to the filibuster, Alan, and I'll throw this to you first. We'll throw it around the room. How important now, absent a change in the filibuster rules, how important is Manchin to all this?
Huge. He's absolutely huge. I would defer to Teresa or Malcolm.
Well, you know, I haven't heard from Ira yet, so...
Ira, I forgot about Ira.
Are you still awake, Ira?
You started talking about a big butt, and I figured you were tossing it over to me.
Actually,
Ira. Oh, my God, Ira.
Now, come on, Ira. I was thinking much more. That's not fair. I was thinking more of Ray.
Ouch.
So,
that hurts.
Don't
me.
Pick on
well,
Ray.
I very much am in favor of the government doing something about infrastructure, and I'm in favor of them doing it big. And you know, this is like somebody who's let a house go without minor repairs, now it's time to make the big repairs, and it's very expensive. I have two points, one of which Alan touched on. The one point is that the definition of infrastructure, as outlined yesterday by Biden, is rather broad. It's broader than what I think most people consider infrastructure to be, which is bridges and rail lines, et cetera. I think we need to hear a little bit more about some of the what I would call auxiliary items that go under an infrastructure bill. And the other thing is regarding the Republicans, they clearly are back into their position of being the party of no. And the question is, are they going to come back with some sort of a compromise or at least some sort of a proposal, which they didn't do during the 4 years of Trump, which would suggest that they don't, if they don't, it would suggest that they don't believe that infrastructure needs to be done, in which case, you know, hold hands because we're all going to fall through more sinkholes than the one Teresa just described.
Go ahead, Teresa.
There's not a member of Congress or senator who doesn't have a bridge in her or his state or district that needs to be repaired, or a road that needs to be repaired, or water pipes, or in our case, City Hall. We have a historic City Hall. When it snows outside, it snows inside in the windows. And we are seeking funding for a comprehensive upgrade of our historic City Hall. There is not an elected member of Congress who does not have similar problems in his or her state or district. And so, of course, you know, infrastructure has been talked about for a long time, but even the person who wrote Trump's infrastructure bill was quoted last night, this morning, in a couple of articles, embracing this, saying that even the funding mechanism was an interesting approach. And so I think there's consensus that there needs to be something done on infrastructure, but we need to stop talking about it and getting it done and get it done.
Well, somebody's got to send that memo to McConnell because his initial foray is it's too expensive, we can't do it.
Yeah. Well, the mayors of this country will send the memo to McConnell and to those are the folks, the mayors, the governors, the county executives who have to deal with this crumbling. And you know who else should send the memo to him is the business people, because they rely on this infrastructure for their commerce. And they should demand this, just like Amtrak gets their people. Sorry, Alan, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
I think we're all sorry.
Yeah, I think we're all sorry, particularly me. But I do want to say that there's still the big bad guy out there, that's Trump. Now, you're quite right, Teresa. Trump had his own infrastructure plans. That didn't happen. Nevertheless, we watched as not one single Republican deviated from the earlier great success that on COVID relief that was put out there. We don't know what Trump is going to say, and we don't know what McConnell is going to say. McConnell is saying it's too expensive. That says, okay, let's talk. Let's dicker on this thing. But if they do what they did on the other bill here, even though it is not, you're so right, Teresa, even though it's absolutely essential for their towns, cities, villages, and states, they could do that because they're so scared of their stinking political careers.
Does it really matter what Trump says anymore?
No.
I think it absolutely does. If this
Where
guy,
is Trump's infrastructure plan? No, it wasn't one of the big jokes of his administration that every 2 weeks he'd promised that it was going to be a plan, and one never emerged.
I don't want to be defending Trump. I'm not defending Trump. I'm simply castigating the Republicans who are scared of their own skins that he's going to get mad at them because he's indicating to a lot of people he will be the candidate the next time. And by the way, I believe that.
Now, we only have 2 minutes here before we have to break for news. And it's, by the way, the Roundtable Panel, and you can email us at panel@wamc.org. Before we break, one of the items that President Biden has mentioned in his infrastructure plan is $100 billion to upgrade the resilience of the power grid. And I wanted to go to our spy and our military guy, Malcolm Nance, here. Does the resilience of the power grid, is this hardening this to EMP?
You know, that. Let me define that for you. That's electromagnetic pulse. That means that if an atomic explosion of high neutrons and low, you know, radioactive yield explodes, it would fry all the electronics. Yeah, that standard was great for the Cold War when we used to think we could actually survive that. But, you know, man-made EMP is not a thing. It's not something that you really need to secure the grid to. The grid needs to be secured in the old school way from hacking via mm-hmm. your electronic controls by having redundant manual controls. And they found that out in Ukraine. Ukraine was attacked by Russia 3 times where they literally seized control of their Russian-built power plants. The Russians had actually recreated of the control rooms and took it over and shut down power for over 1 million people for strategic purposes, right? For we don't know what kind of activities they were covering up, but they did it deliberately to send these messages. That's what we need to secure our grid for. Also, to be able to handle the kind of power we're going to need in 30, 40, 50 years. Not the, you know, I mean, our grid, let's be honest, was built on World War II. That was the highest level of demand that we had. And we've just been improving upon, or not improving, we've been band-aiding it the whole time. So we could spend, if we spent $500 billion on the electrical and the power generation and putting it into solar and and giving more incentives for people to have solar.
Yeah.
I mean, you could make the United States almost energy independent. Well, we're sort of that way now.
I'll stop you guys there. We're going to have to take a break here for news, but we'll delve more into President Biden's infrastructure proposal and the tax increase proposals as well. This is the Roundtable Panel. Alan Shartok, Teresa Bourgeois, Ira Fussfeld, and Malcolm Nance join us. And once again, you can join us by emailing panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We will break for just a bit of news, and we'll be back.
And the race is run, and the goal is won. Look how far we've come, dancing in the sun. It is then.
That's new music from Valerie June's album, The Moon of the Stars, Prescription for Dreamers, and this is the Roundtable Panel. It's not ostensibly a music show, but we like to give you a little music info. It's 9:33, a Thursday morning. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue, and we have the Roundtable Panel in progress. Teresa Bourgeois is here from the city of Cohoes. She told me it's a historic city, and I believe her. WAMC's Alan Shartok. Ira Fussfeld is here, basically goes to OTB now, but he used to be the publisher of the Daily Freeman, also counterterrorism.
You don't have to go when it's on the computer.
That's right, man. I forgot. Also, best-selling author, counterterrorism expert Malcolm Nance on the panel. Now, before we get to the letters, and you, by the way, at home can write us at panel@wamc.org. Before we get to the letters, let's just go through some of the tax increases that President Biden's plan would be financed by. And if you are wondering what the plan is, yesterday he unveiled a $2.3 trillion infrastructure plan that he says would help us win the future. It's a nice phrase, but the future always wins, whether it's an asteroid strike or a nuclear war. The ending is usually the same. Biden's tax increases would be raising the corporate tax from 21% to 28%, one of the measures that over 15 years would cover the cost of this infrastructure plan and reduce the deficit, imposing a 21% global minimum tax. And I guess the plan here is that companies then couldn't avoid taxes by shifting to countries with low taxes. It would make it harder for businesses to merge with foreign companies to avoid taxes, a process that we now know is called inversion. eliminating tax breaks for companies that shift assets abroad, imposing a 15% minimum tax on the income that corporations report to shareholders, eliminating tax preferences for fossil fuels, increasing IRS audits of large corporations. That's it so far. Alan Chartok, A, is that enough? B, politically, is it too much?
No, I think if it's what he says it is, then he's going to be in great shape. The problem is that this stuff tends to come back down on the middle class taxpayer and the upper middle class taxpayer. And that would be unacceptable. So from a political point of view, if he can keep it there, look, Ray, as you know, there are major corporations right around here. I'm not going to give two initials or anything like that.
Oh, boy. Okay.
Why would I do that?
I don't know.
But who pay nothing? Nothing. Not a nuka. Nothing. These laws have been written so that they get off scot-free, off all too often. Not everybody, but all too often. And so, you know, there's an alternative minimum tax that we taxpayers pay. It's reprehensible. And, you know, just when you think you're doing good in terms of all of the laws, you're not. So I'm saying if he could keep it with the corporations and the businesses that are doing extremely well, I think most people will like it.
Alan.
Teresa.
Yeah, I agree with Alan because, as Alan pointed out, typically these infrastructure projects are paid for with gas tax increases or things like that. Well, it hasn't happened in a long time, but that's what always people always point to. But if you do it on gas taxes, then you're doing it on the backs of working folks, right, and the poor. It affects them disproportionately. And what the Biden team is saying is let's do it by closing some corporate welfare loopholes that they've been trying to close for years. Back in the 90s when I was working in the Senate, this was many of those things were on our list too. And then also have enforcement so that people actually at the top end of the economic spectrum actually pay their taxes. But, you know, I just checked, what did it, a few weeks ago in early March, there were those blackouts in Texas, right? And there were problems with the electric grid. That has a $130 billion price tag and lost in damages, economic damages. So, you know, there's a benefit to these corporations to pay their fair share and therefore benefit from these upgrades and improvements. And that's what they're saying.
Well, those people who think that the taxes on the corporations, et cetera, are either too big or not fair, then my question is, then how, if we agree that the infrastructure needs addressing, how do you propose to pay for it? And again, we're not hearing any alternative suggestions to the one that Biden has put out there. I would say this, and maybe I'm wrong, I hope I'm wrong, but if in fact the corporations and big businesses do get socked with a much higher tax, it's I think naive to think that the average citizen won't somehow get impacted as well. It'll trickle down to them in some form or another. Now, I'm not suggesting that that's a reason not to do the infrastructure, but I do think it ultimately it will be more than just the big businesses that are going to be paying the tariff for this.
You know, Teresa, you worked in the Senate as a congressional intern. I hung around the House of Representatives, and there's a street that leads right away from, you know, the White House and the Congress. It's called K Street. Mm-hmm. And on K Street, as you know all too well, Teresa, you know, if you have a beehive outside your house, that's what it is. It's a lobbyist beehive. And they get down there and they earn their big, big bucks. And somehow that gets translated into contributions to people's campaigns, politicians' campaigns. And that's how we've gotten where we are. Basically, it is a legal bribe. And it's been that way for a long time. So to assume that this is going to be an easy lift would just be wrong.
I don't think it's going to be easy lift. And that's why I said, well, when I worked in the Senate and I was the director of communications for the Labor and Human Resources Committee, and one of the things that Senator Kennedy at the time was the chair focused on was closing some of these corporate welfare loopholes. So I'm saying that some of these efforts go back to the 90s and probably
absolutely
before then. So if it was easy, it would have been done. I absolutely agree with you. It's not going to be easy. But to Ira's point earlier about the Trump, they had a proposal of what to do, but they never put out a proposal of how to pay for it because there wasn't consensus among McConnell's conference, among the Republicans, about how to pay for it. And so that's what needs to be resolved here is how do you pay for it? But we're paying one way or the other. Either we pay to get the work done or we pay because the work is not done. Either way, we're paying.
Yeah, but it's the equity of the equalness of the paying effort that is so important. Now, somebody will call and write and say, hey, my husband or my wife will lose her job because you are going to be making it so much harder for major corporations, some that used to be in Schenectady, some that used to be in Pittsfield, got the used to be part, and who may not be paying what they should be paying now, they're going to lose their jobs, and you're going to be responsible for having espoused this on the radio.
Well, I think just like the clean energy, people have talked about clean energy and say that, well, you know, you can have green or you can have jobs, but you can't have both. And I think what people have come to realize, and the research shows and the data shows, that if you move toward a clean energy economy, and what's interesting about this infrastructure bill is it's really focused on combining both clean energy approaches as well as infrastructure approaches to make them not compete but collaborate. You do create jobs. So you may, it's like the coal issue. You may lose jobs in the coal mines, but you have to create jobs in the same area that are replacement jobs that have a longer term viability. And that's what Hillary Clinton was trying to say, but didn't say it, but said it ineloquently during her campaign and suffered for that. But it's, you will create jobs if you invest in infrastructure. And maybe that, you know, Trump lowered the tax rates on corporations down to, what was it, 21%?
I think 21%, yes.
Right. And so they said that the sweet spot, I don't know, I'm so far out of my swim lane now, but is 25%. So Biden's folks are proposing 28%. So say they end up at 25%, that'll work too, right? And so I think that there is room for compromise here. But either way, it's costing us. Right now, it's costing our country a lot of money that you don't have high-speed rail between Washington and New York, between New York and Albany, between New York and Boston, let alone around the country, or that we don't have a good electric grid, or that our water infrastructure is crumbling. You know, our bridges aren't safe. If we invest in these, it will create jobs for those people you're talking about.
Now, Malcolm, the question I have for you as our expert on international relations on the panel today, the mention of the Chinese were mentioned. I remember in the old days we had to do everything Sputnik and everything else because of the Russians. Now, the Chinese were mentioned as having done, you know, kept their economy going and their infrastructure going. What do you make of all of that?
I think he's gone. Malcolm, are you there?
I say, Malcolm, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
He's waiting for his turn. It's been a while. Hello, Malcolm. Welcome back.
Do you want me to repeat the question?
No, I heard the question.
Oh,
The difference between us and the Chinese is that they are still a communist country. They're a dictatorship. And they can designate what the state's money is being used for. It's just that now, instead of having, you know, essentially Chinese worker bees, they have thousands of billionaires who are inputting money into the government, or the government can seize money. So when they say they want to spend $2 or $3 trillion on the Great Belt and Road Initiative that essentially connects China by mainland to everything in the Eastern Hemisphere, they can do it. If they put in high-speed rail between Beijing and Shanghai, it goes in. We have to negotiate, right? We have to deal with democracy as it is. And in that part of the discussion where you're wondering, how are we going to wrench that money out of the billionaires, and the corporations who are going to pass it down to us, this is where democracy is, you know, one step forward, three steps back, three steps forward, one step back. And we just have to, you know, adjust to the reality that if we're going to do big, bold things, and this is where I think Joe Manchin is going to lose a little bit of his power. you know, projects have to go through West Virginia. And for him to say, I don't want hundreds of billions of dollars in Kentucky, in Pennsylvania, in Ohio, and all these adjoining states that would flow into West Virginia, he won't be in, and there will be a Republican in that job soon enough. So I think as a nation, we have to take this as sort of a, you know, a Marshall Plan or a moonshot or whatever you want to call it. But we have to get the 50 Democrats to all agree to this, and also to agree that they're not going to have, you know, filibuster rules are going to go by the old rules, where you got to stand up until you collapse, and once you collapse, we can take a vote.
All right, let's
so
take a
break. That's the only way it'll happen.
Let's take a break. That's a good spot to do that. I have been remiss. We have not read one listener email yet, and we'll do that.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. We'll do it on. It was so exciting. We'll do it on the other side of the break, though. The email address here is panel@wamc.org. Alan Chartok, Ira Fussfeld, Teresa Bourgeois, and Malcolm Nance. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel. It's 9:47. It's a Thursday morning. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. And our panel today, Malcolm Nance, Teresa Bourgeois, Ira Fussfeld, and Alan Chartok. The email address is panel@wamc.org. This email from Amy. Kudos from President Biden for wise use of funding. One aspect of roads improvement people may not realize is the impact on greenhouse gases. Roughly 28% of greenhouse gas emissions come from idling vehicles. Improving roads and bridges means more fluid traffic flow, less idling, and fewer emissions. Anybody?
Well, sorry, I'm talking too much, but
go
I'm
ahead.
All over the infrastructure issue.
Not at all.
Actually, an interesting thing, she's absolutely right, and an interesting thing that we're looking at is traffic lights. Traffic lights cost about $120,000 a piece. If we could switch out our traffic lights, we would reduce idling time throughout our city. We have 24 of them. We would reduce idling time, and that would help as part of our overall Cleaner, Greener, Cohoes initiative to, you know, to improve the environment, right? But to do that, $120,000 a piece. But not, you do want to keep traffic flowing. And there is smart technology that can do that, but and we know it. The question is, how can we afford it?
What's that technology look like, Teresa?
What is it? Well,
I'm fascinated by that.
There are traffic lights that determine at an intersection if a car is waiting or not. So right now you come up to a light, you stop. If it's a smart light, if there's no traffic coming in the direction where it's green, it'll switch and the... You know, if you're at red and waiting, there's no one coming and where it's going green, it'll switch and allow you to go through.
I wish they'd try that on Quail Street in Albany. That would make my commute a little quicker. This one is from Michael, and it's really long. Let's see here. Oh, good heavens.
You're not supposed to do that, right?
Right. All right, we're going to read it anyway. Why has no one brought up the option of a gasoline tax? We have experienced a windfall profit with all of the new oil, and the price is dollars below what it used to be. 50 cents per gallon for the last 5 years would not have been a problem, as we are seeing our gas prices increase with no or little opposition. This relates directly to those who use the crumbling infrastructure, should they pay. The Robert Moses era originally set up the toll system to pay for the upkeep, yet that money now goes to the general funds. No one ever brings up this great disproportionate benefit we enjoy, the gas tax that the Eisenhower interstate system is static as opposed to a percentage. We probably need to spend $5 trillion, and that's from Michael.
Well, as I said earlier, because it weighs disproportionately on lower-income people, and so they're trying a different, more equitable routes. But No doubt it will become part of the conversation.
We're going to throw this one to Ira to see if he's awake. Hello, Ira. This is from Tristan. How effective is raising the corporate tax rate when so many of the richest companies use loopholes to pay little or nothing? Won't raising the rate just punish those that don't or can't take advantage of the loopholes? Wouldn't we raise more money if we found a way to close the loopholes and make Amazon, GE, Exxon, Mobil, etc. pay the full rate that already exists?
Well, I think the answer is yes. I mean, if there are loopholes built into the system and they're being exploited, let's close the loopholes. I mean, there are so many places I would think to look for areas where corporations should pay some, if not more, taxes, and that's one of them is the loopholes. I had a question that I'd sort of toss out there. The figure was a $2.3 trillion in spending over 8 years. Would they be better off, they meaning Biden administration, be better off if they had split this proposal up and separate the more traditional infrastructure needs, bridges, roads, etc., and then set a separate bill for the greenhouse initiatives and things of that sort, building, what was one of the things I saw here, improving health care by building more health care facilities. Maybe it would make it easier to get one or both of those through if there were two proposals instead of one. Or Alan, is it make more sense politically to just roll up this big ball into a giant ball of string and throw it in there all at one time?
No, I think the better thing is passing each bill is very tough, Ira. So better off, as you say, one big thing.
Well, I think you make a point. And one of the things brought up earlier, I think by Ira, was some of the things are not traditional infrastructure in this bill. And one argument you could make is $400 billion, which is one of the largest segments of this, is earmarked for expanding long-term care under Medicaid. And that might have been a tough sell on its own.
Exactly. You know, and
we did hear. And we did hear.
I would credit Cuomo for was insisting on repairing and replacing the old Tappan Zee Bridge. Can you imagine if that project had not occurred and that bridge continued to deteriorate, and it would be only at any time something catastrophic could have happened on that bridge, and that's what's going to happen in countless other bridges around this country unless something is done. And that seems to me to be the sales pitch. You've got to fix these bridges, for example, or you're going to be in the water looking up when those bridges start collapsing.
All right, let's throw this one to Malcolm. We're trying to keep all of our panelists awake today, and it's tough to do this when we're in the studio. We can sort of nudge people and keep them awake, but this is all remote. This one's from Doug, Malcolm, and I'll let you handle this. Republicans will not help Biden pass legislation because they want the country to fail under his leadership. They did the same thing 12 years ago when Mitch McConnell said he wanted to make Obama a one-term president. Elected Republicans care nothing for the welfare of the U.S. They care only about their own power. Malcolm Nance, the floor is yours, sir.
I find it interesting that the Republicans under Trump were the ones who did away with earmarks, the old school method of tagging money into infrastructure money, various monies into specific states and districts in order to get the votes of those congressmen and senators. That's back now.
Yeah.
Earmarking is back. So imagine the earmarking that can go on. I keep pointing to West Virginia. In a state like West Virginia, where they could get a disproportionate share of money that could bring that state, out of the 1930s and at least into the 1990s. So,
yes.
I mean, that is a powerful draw.
And a good way of buying a vote.
What's that?
And a good way of buying a vote.
Yes, it's a great way of buying a vote. And it worked for, pretty much 200 years until it was dismantled. And the Republicans saw that they could just take all the money and secretly earmark it to each other with a wink and a nod. So now this infrastructure bill needs to be massive, massive, to show that the United States is not playing. Again, the Chinese are eating our lunch internationally. There are ports in this country that need billions of dollars for upgrade that we can't handle containers or the right. loads of containers that are being shipped from everywhere. And we can't be economically competitive. Anything we can do to make this country faster, better, increase more jobs. And, you know, they're talking 2 million jobs out of this at the very least, with a growth rate of 6%. Hey, it's worth the money.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Teresa.
I wanted to ask Malcolm if it's okay. Malcolm, do you think that this is a not only global competitiveness issue, but also, you know, a national security issue?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We have really severe national security implications going on. The United States for the last 4 years, technically you could go further back than that, from right back to where Mitch McConnell said he wanted nothing to happen under Barack Obama, which pretty much crippled the country. So we're talking 12 years of stagnant growth, even though Obama managed to have one of the best economies in history. It could have been way better. We are finding out on the geopolitical map that China is just has just replaced the United States as a major player in the world. People didn't listen to us at all in the Trump years. Everyone knew that we were a stupid country being led by a fool, and that now they could step into our markets. We have military alliances, political alliances, and we are hemorrhaging allies or potential clients for our, you know, businesses because of everything Donald Trump did.
No.
Not only is China investing in its own infrastructure, but isn't it investing in infrastructure all over the world, Malcolm?
Oh, yeah. China owns Africa. Did you guys know that?
Yeah.
And that's why the Russians are now there in Africa. It's like the early 1960s all over again. China just goes to countries, say, we'll build infrastructure for you. We'll send you clean clothes instead of clothes from the Salvation Army, and we'll help you get richer. The United States does none of that. So when we fix ourselves, we really need to start helping the world. And sending coronavirus vaccines around could be the first step in that to regaining our allies.
Let's take a quick break here. This is the Roundtable panel on WAMC, and we have many more letters to read, many more things to talk about. It's a great panel today. Counterterrorism expert and best-selling author Malcolm Nance joins us. Publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman, Ira Fussfeld, is here. Cohoes City Director of Operations, Teresa Bourgeois, and WAMC's Alan Shartok. And once again, you can join us. Panel at WAMC.org is the email address. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Roundtable on WAMC. We're listening to music in our bumper music from Valerie June. The new album is The Moon and the Stars, Prescription for Dreamers. And as always, you can find our playlists online at WAMC.org/roundtable. This is the Roundtable, and it's the Roundtable panel. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue at 10:06 on a Thursday morning. And if you had told me last night when I was sipping my bourbon that I would spend an hour talking about infrastructure, I would have said you were stone cold nuts. But we have done just that. And, you know, it's kind of a big deal. President Biden has outlined a $2.3 trillion plan, and it's a big infrastructure plan. We've been talking about it with our panel today, Alan Shartok, Teresa Bourgeois, Ira Fussfeld, and Malcolm Nance. And we just started getting to some of the listener mail before the news. And this one's from John. John said, some Republicans will oppose this bill because they'll say it's too expensive. But also many progressives will oppose the bill because it's not nearly expensive enough. There is an alternative infrastructure plan out there, a $10 trillion plan over 10 years that would address not only Biden's infrastructure wants, but also would be transformational for the economy dealing with climate change. I do hope we can avoid the nonsense question about how do we pay for it. It'll pay for itself. And that's from John. Alan, do you agree?
No. He's going to have plenty of trouble getting you know, this bill through for the trillions on top of the program he just passed. I understand where our letter writer is coming from, but that's pie in the sky.
I assume the $10 trillion that our listener was referring to was the Green New Deal, Teresa.
Yes, it was. But there was also an assumption there that I think, well, that is absolutely not correct, which is it says that this is not a green proposal. I mean, the fascinating thing about the Biden proposal is he delivered what he promised, which is it is an infrastructure bill with a keen eye toward the green economy and the future economy and providing incentivizing a move in that direction, by modernizing buildings, but in a way that makes them more energy efficient, by creating a electric vehicle infrastructure. You know, you can build all the electric cars you want, but you also have to have infrastructure for them to plug in, right? And so that's part of this, clean buses. You know, we're exploring how do you have clean energy dump trucks and garbage trucks and such. They're just the market is not there for those things yet, and this incentivizes that market and creates the infrastructure you would need to move that market. So there is definitely green infrastructure built into this Biden proposal.
You know, it occurs to me that part of the issue that we may be looking at from a national security standpoint with regard to electric vehicles is the fact, and I believe this to be true, that some of the materials in these long-term batteries and these really high-test batteries that are used in vehicles, so some of those materials, they come from China. Malcolm Nance, is that an issue that has to be addressed?
You know, that is a very interesting fact, that there are materials that are used in these super advanced lithium batteries that are called rare earth minerals.
Right.
And prior to the 1970s, the United States dominated this market of rare earth minerals. And these are minerals that are still around. They're not actually minerals, they're elements. It's just extracting them is exceptionally expensive. And it is a national security priority that we keep that, because we not only use rare earth minerals in power plants and batteries, but in computers. Silicon's a rare earth mineral. So this is something that it's an industry that's pretty much died out in the United States, or was bought or sold by American manufacturers, sold to the Chinese. So, you know, dominating things in like electric vehicles, which I understand part of this plan, I don't know if it's this plan, but one of the proposals was that the GSA, the Government Service Administration, and the Post Office would switch over all vehicles to electric vehicles, which means that our, you know, our nuclear power plants, our solar, our wind, and other types of renewables could actually start sustaining us instead of that massive oil infrastructure we've come to rely on.
The email.
Where is our leverage, Malcolm? If we become more and more reliant on these kinds of things coming out of China, and they have us in effect over a barrel, where can we leverage ourselves?
Yeah, our leverage comes in the fact that we need to take this to $1.2 trillion and do like the military, where you mandate everything must be purchased in the United States, whatever the expense. Mm-hmm. We need to re-jumpstart specialized American manufacturing and stop giving it to the Chinese, cutting costs. Things that are made in the United States should be made in the United States. And I don't mean all the parts manufactured in China, then shipped to Guam, and then are put together by essentially slave labor and slapped with a made in the USA stamp. I mean, solar panels. I live in Columbia County. There used to be a big solar manufacturer here near Chatham, and they're still doing it, but they were wiped out, I think, at one point by all these cheap solar panels that, as I understand it, Republican state assemblymen were invested in that bought to this state that took over the solar industry. We need to bring that back to the states and into our individual states as well.
Alan.
I just wanted to read a letter, if I may, Ray, from Leslie. Just for your information, Manchin a few days ago called for a huge infrastructure bill funded by a rise in corporate taxes to 25%. West Virginia would have its abandoned remediated, among other things, and Biden just appointed Mrs. Manchin to some huge Appalachian post. Well, whatever it takes. I think that's a very important letter, assuming it's true.
Well, we have not vetted that one, but thank you for reading it all the same. This
do
one's
we,
from
do, do, do we always vet them?
I don't know. I just get what Sarah LaDuke sends me. This is from John. Hey. Infrastructure is a national security issue, says John. The federal government constructed the interstate highway system to transport intercontinental ballistic missiles rapidly on trucks in the event of war. And this one
Good point.
This one
hey,
is
quick point.
Sure.
about that last one about Manchin. Hey, how did my ancestors get emancipated, right? Lincoln had to bribe somebody with being Postmaster General in Ohio.
Yep.
If it needs to be done, I think now's a good time.
That's what it's all about.
This is from Vincent. Let's get real. The only reason McConnell opposes it is because if Biden gets it through, it'll create millions of jobs and usher in an era of unprecedented prosperity. It has nothing to do with being too expensive. And that is from Vincent.
But the question is, can his members afford to not get on board with this infrastructure initiative? I mean, I think that's it. There needs to create an environment in which it's politically impossible for them, or at least 10 of them, not to get on board.
Anybody?
I don't know, Teresa. I hope you're right, but they sure didn't show an awful lot of compassion for all those people who couldn't put food on the table in the $3 trillion, COVID relief bill. So you can say it, and it makes sense when you say it, but I don't think these folks have a bottom.
Well, I think that they can, first of all, they'll see that it's so popular, so there might be some regret there, but also they can argue that this is different because it's not giving people money, it's putting them back to work. But again, this is putting money into each of their districts, putting essential resources into each of their districts. Now, the other half of this package that the president has not announced yet is the human infrastructure portion of this, which will be equally important, because if you're going to have all this construction, you're going to need to have people with the skills to do it. And so that's coming up next. Part two is the human infrastructure portions.
I'm at a loss. What do you mean human infrastructure?
Education, job training, readiness skills, so that you train people to do the work that needs to be done.
All right, this is from Donald. A comment on the infrastructure piece and particularly the response of conservatives. The criticism that I've heard so far centers around what they call liberal or even Marxist priorities that are being inserted into the bill under the so-called guise of infrastructure. They seem to try to be making the case by saying that only a small fraction of the spending has to do with roads and bridges, and they don't buy the premise that the other items in the bill really fall under the auspices of infrastructure. Any comment on that? I find it ridiculous, but that's their argument, and that's from Donald.
That's hilarious. That's right up there with Governor Kristi Noem of South Dakota saying yesterday that she doesn't want to spend all this money on infrastructure, that, you know, the liberals are going to spend it on houses and pipes and plumbing. I mean, she doesn't even know what infrastructure is. So when I hear people use the word Marxist, you don't even know the definition of Marxist, right? Investing in people infrastructure, like getting people off of heroin in West Virginia, which is state du jour, and getting them out there and building roads, bridges, sidewalks, parks, other things like the Great Hudson. I mean, we have the Hudson Albany Electric Trail here. My village fought that tooth and nail. They did not want it. They thought it was a sign of liberalism. It increased the housing values of all the houses along that trail.
Exactly.
I mean, it's just crazy.
Right. And that's why we have the Erie Canal, initial locks of the Erie Canal run through Cohoes, and we are trying to revive the Erie Canal, Cohoes Erie Canal Parkway, and revive it as a park. And if we are able to do that, it will do just what Malcolm says. It will make the city more walkable. It will increase the value of all the homes around it. These things improve these investments not only provide jobs in the short term, but improve the economy over the long term.
Tim writes, I have read that the interstate highway system was built as part of a strategic defense system during the Cold War. That's right. I happened to be alive during that time. The real plan of the system was for logistical support in case of war. In other words, transporting weapons and war infrastructure coast to coast. Has Malcolm heard of this? I certainly have. Malcolm?
Oh, certainly I've heard of it. I've read books about President Eisenhower. Look, this is the guy who fought his way into Nazi Germany and realized that Nazi Germany had a highway system and the United States was going on two-lane roads and dirt back roads. So for the United States to be powerful in the Cold War, he saw that connecting all 50 states. I've driven across the country at least six times, back and forth. And we could do a lot better because many of the infrastructure that peels off from the main highway system is terrible. It's really bad. And we rely on these small locales. And not to mention the infrastructure that's also on there is all oriented towards gas. And if we could wean ourselves off of oil, it would make the trillions we spend in the Middle East, put it into our pockets and send it out and stop drug addiction or something.
And Alan, you know, what did we do after World War II in Europe? We invested in the Marshall Plan. And if, you know, that was an infrastructure project to bring back the European economy, right? And we need to do that in our own country right now.
We do, and we can't afford to make mistakes. Somebody wrote in, I don't have it before me, and said instead of lights, we should have traffic circles. Well, I disagree with that, I hope...
Why?
And
they work very well.
Excuse me, I haven't finished my sentence.
Oh, fine, go ahead.
Yeah. And traffic circles, I tend to... There are a lot of them in New Jersey. I don't want to start up on New Jersey, so I won't right now. But I'm going to tell you right now, Route 7 is the major artery that goes through Great Barrington and all the way up into Williamstown and everything else. You start putting traffic circles in, as they do in New Jersey and other places, and you're going to see a very slow traffic pattern. I am opposed to...
Well, you are wrong, sir.
No, I'm right, sir.
You're incorrect.
The city of Kingston, the state actually put in a traffic circle at the interchange of the thruway in Kingston, and it's one of the more unpopular things that has ever happened around here. I happen to like it, but people generally don't, and they're in completing another traffic circle in the city per se, and I suspect we'll get a lot of complaints about that. But the design of these things is to slow down traffic, because otherwise cars were blasting through the interchanges and there were many accidents. So I think they've served their purpose in slowing down traffic, but they're very unpopular.
You know, I think they also speed up traffic. To be honest with you, depending on the intersection, and I know plenty of them, where the traffic at rush hour would back up for a half a mile, and now it flows very smoothly. It took about a year for me to get used to driving in traffic circles, but I'm all for them now.
And I'm all against them. And you can read that in the Berkshire Edge this weekend.
Oh, that's what this is all about. Saturday, self-promotion. Yes. I understand.
Yeah, it very much so.
All right, fair enough. Anybody else want to weigh in on traffic circles before we move on?
Roundabouts do reduce idling, but they don't work in all locations.
That's
no,
right.
They should be targeted to areas which have low flows of traffic from one direction on occasion, because traffic lights are not the greatest things in the world. I'll tell you this much. I did a BBC documentary in England, and I drove a car there for 2 months.
Yeah.
And every intersection in the whole country is a traffic circle. And I woke up at night hearing my GPS going at the roundabout, the third exit.
Did you have trouble driving on the other side of the road?
Only in Wales, when I took my Mercedes rental and I ripped the side of it by doing a hard 90-degree turn. My mind was not on right-hand drive.
Yeah. And I'm sure they're fine with Americans doing that over there, right?
No Americans driving there except for me.
Oh, fair enough. At least you're driving a Mercedes. Good for you. It's a roundtable panel. Malcolm Nance, Ira Fussfeld, Teresa Bourgeois, and Alan Shartok. The email address is panel@wamc.org if you want to weigh in on roundabouts and such. Some of Georgia's most prominent corporate leaders on Wednesday began to move more forcefully criticize the state's sweeping new election law, acknowledging concerns of civil rights activists. The chief executives of Delta Airlines and Coca-Cola pivoted from earlier more equivocal statements and called the law unacceptable. Republican Governor Brian Kemp signed the law last week and says these corporations, they're misinterpreting the law. Alan.
Pass. I pass to Teresa.
Cheers to Ken Chenault, former executive of American Express, and Ken Frazier, chief executive of Merck, for leading this effort. And good for these other corporations for following the effort. I think these efforts to change, to hinder voting in Georgia around the country are extraordinarily serious threat to our democracy, and it needs to be called out.
And how do you do it, Teresa? You do it by passing a national law, right?
If you can get a you don't want to nationalize the voting systems, but what you want to do is slow down these efforts. You know, the Republicans have very targeted efforts state by state, and those need to be slowed down. And you do want the Senate and the House to enact the Congressman John Lewis Voting Rights Act for sure. And the second voting rights bill, I think, will be a little harder to pass. But you do want to do some things at the national level. But these targeted state efforts by the Republicans to block people from voting need to be slowed down and stopped. I mean, if the only way you can win is by blocking people from voting, then you shouldn't be in the game.
Shouldn't, shmouldn't, but how do you do it? I mean, you're telling us you have to be careful about what you're doing on the national level, right? And on the other hand, we have this going on. So it's got to be stopped. You're right, it's a national disgrace. We all know it, but it's got to be stopped. Where do you do it? How do you do it?
Well, you engage the corporate community, as Ken Chenault is, but this shouldn't just be left to the prominent black business leaders. Everybody should be, you know, in this discussion. Who cares about the fundamentals of our democracy? You need to rally the various constituencies around the country, and the work that Ken Chenault is doing with the business community, I think, is extremely important. Now, that's targeted to Georgia, but it's all around the country. This problem isn't.
And where were these Georgia corporations before the vote? I mean, I saw a tweet from Mike Barnicle, and Mike Barnicle, you may know him now from Morning Joe, but he made his bones at the Boston Globe until he was fired for plagiarism. And
yeah.
So I'm going to quote him, although I hope he didn't plagiarize it. But he said after the Delta Airlines chairman came out against the initiative in Georgia, Barnicle said Delta was late again. And I think that's right. These corporate people, I think, had enough warning that they could have opened their mouths before the bill had already been passed. Would it have made any difference? I don't know. We'll never know. And the question is now, will it make any difference what they're saying now?
Well,
I know.
Coca-Cola, Home Depot, Delta. I'm sorry.
Yeah. To what end?
No, wait. But it would not have made a difference because the because you're quite right, because the Republicans have decided they are on the way out. And the only way they can survive is to cheat. And to cheat changes the law, makes it harder to vote for people who they know will vote against them. That's the problem right now. It's awful, and I hope that some of the court cases that are being brought to the United States Supreme Court work, although, because it is the Trump court, I have my doubts.
Okay.
Ira, I think some of these guys in the last few days have admitted that they were late to the game and that they were wrong. I believe it was Delta.
Well, that's good that they are willing to admit it. So the question is, can they be effective opening their mouths now? I mean, I don't know what they can threaten. It's hard for me to believe that Delta would pick up its hub and move somewhere else, that Coca-Cola will do the same. Somebody said that Coca-Cola owns one of the bottled water companies. I can't pronounce it, Dance or something like that, but that they would give out free water on lines to defy the law that prevents people from getting water. But I don't know what they can do at this point.
Well, can you get them to reverse some of the really egregious aspects of the law that was passed in Georgia? And with the attention now, I mean, I think that Georgia passing this legislation really woke people up around the country. It had been discussed, but it was under the radar screen, and I think it's really woken people up, and hopefully it'll make a difference in the other states, and hopefully, you know, they're definitely going to go to court on some of these egregious aspects of the Georgia
Now, which are the egregious aspects? The new law, as I understand it, adds a photo ID requirement for voting absentee. Cuts the number of time people have to request an absentee ballot and limits where drop boxes can be placed, among other things. Then there's the food and water aspect that you guys have talked about on the show. But, Teresa, what do you consider to be the egregious part of this?
I think if you limit where drop boxes are, and you are limiting those in areas of where the predominantly people of color live, that's a problem. I think if you have provisions that allow you to take over certain counties' voting procedures, and you go and do that in counties that have, if you're a Republican governor, and you do that in counties that have traditionally voted Democrat, and you do things like reduce the number of polling places and such like that, that's a problem. So, those I consider, obviously, they were flat out stupid to allow to leave the provision in that you can't give people water in line. I mean, that just
the optics are bad for sure.
Right? Yeah. I mean, I'm glad that they did, but that's, you know, somebody wasn't thinking very well strategically there, which is good because it's so outrageous. It's so outrageous. But I think that things like limiting the number of drop boxes, particularly in areas of low income and minority people live, is targeting who you want and don't want to vote. Hours of operation for, I mean, you see the difference between the lines of voters in inner cities and the lines in suburbia. 10 minutes in suburbia, 10 hours in inner cities. Literally. That's not democratic.
We have to take a break, unfortunately, here. Malcolm, you haven't had a chance to weigh in. I'll give you 15 seconds before the break if you want to discuss this, and then we'll hit it on the other side.
Yeah, H.R. 1 has to pass. And if we do H.R. 1 at the same time that we are floating the infrastructure bill, that's how you get Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema to come along to change the filibuster rules. So that we can get that passed, and it will kill all 351 of these knives dead that are being passed around the country.
All right, we're going to take a break right there. Panel at WAMC.org is the email address, panel@WAMC.org. Malcolm Nance, Ira Fussfeld, Teresa Bourgeois, Alan Chartok on the panel. Just one letter here before we go, and I won't give Alan a chance. Ray is right, Alan is wrong. Traffic circles slow peak speeds, but improve overall throughput compared to traffic lights, and that's from Jules. And thank you, Jules. Thank you. Yes, it's the final stretch of the roundtable, as Muhammad Ali used to call rounds 13, 14, and 15. This is the championship causeway, and it is at 10:33 on a Thursday morning. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue, and it's the roundtable panel. Malcolm Nance, Ira Fussfeld, Teresa Bourgeois, and Alan Chartok on the panel. This email from Anthony. Anthony says, seems to me some form of infrastructure bill is the biggest form of pork barrel politics ever. Everyone gets to eat. Bring home the bacon. Alan.
That's what it's all about. That's what it's always been all about. And, of course, Teresa is very correct in bringing up the idea that you're going to be able to negotiate what you want with the local constituencies in order to get their votes. And Joe Manchin is a perfect example, you know, of that. And this he's going to be largely acceptable because he said all along he wants this kind of an infrastructure program.
And
there
Alan,
have been examples.
I'm
sorry. There have been examples over the last couple of weeks of Republicans who are touting the benefits to their markets of the COVID relief bill. And of course, these are the same people who voted against the bill, but now they're taking credit for the projects that are going to result from it.
And we all knew that was going to happen from day one. We all predicted that would happen, and it has indeed happened. It's disgusting.
The email address here is panel@WAMC.org. This is from Judith. What happens if we move too far forward with electric vehicles before retooling our electrical grid system? All it would take to stop us, literally, would be an attack on the power grid. We throw it to Malcolm, who is now gone.
That's interesting. Oh, sorry. No, I just had to
unmute.
Take my mute off.
Right.
It's interesting, but that's not the way we should think about things. You know, I don't let terrorists determine my travel planning. Our infrastructure produces more than enough electricity. It's a question of how we get that electricity. You know, we introduce more solar, more wind power. And, you know, I mean, if you have solar at your house, you can get an electric plug installed right there, next to your driveway. It's a question of having more resources on the road, more EVs on the road, electric vehicles, and then business wants your money. They will install the solar electric infrastructure to power these vehicles.
Now, especially Malcolm? Do you have an electric vehicle?
No,
I do not have. I don't have one either. And so my question is the power outlet, is it like a 220 plug that you would put a washer or dryer in with, or is it something more specified, more specific?
It's more specified, but you get an electrician to tie it to your power, your house. And then that connects right to the vehicle, and it draws right off your electricity. But, you know, I got to tell you something. I made a major change this year in my home infrastructure from oil to gas.
Yeah.
And it is an order of magnitude cheaper. I mean, so if I could get enough solar to add to this, you know, to this giant place, which I have enough roof space for, that would also cut things. And, you know. And if you've been in an electric car, I've been in Teslas, you know, I have friends who drive Teslas, and I'm just fascinated by those things. But it requires us to bring more onto the market. These things go like 100 miles per, you know, or hundreds of miles per charge as opposed to per gallon. And if the post office goes over and brings in thousands and thousands of EVs and the Defense Department is huge into the research of this. They're trying to get away from having to have super tanker after super tanker bring oil and gas out to rubber bladders out to the middle of the desert that's full of sun.
Right, because as I understand it, heavy lift is like the biggest logistical aspect of any military operation.
Yeah, just moving ginormous amounts of fuel is one of the... we're spending hundreds of billions of dollars of that. Just to keep the military moving in circles.
Energy. And imagine the benefits of reducing the demand for Middle East oil, too. The geopolitical benefits of reducing that. And if we could tap the sun and the wind, that would help. And also, a key piece of the president's proposal is buildings. And, you know, if you make schools and municipal buildings and hospitals and public housing more energy efficient, then you reduce demand in that way as well. So it's all intertwined. And we haven't yet talked about Transportation Secretary Buttigieg, but he has just really been spectacular on these issues.
Well, he backtracked pretty fast on the tax per mile proposal that he had floated last week.
You stumped me on that one. I don't know that one.
In other words, possibly paying for parts of the infrastructure bill by taxing drivers per mile, basically.
Is that like a gas tax?
I don't know.
It's
how
like
it would
a movement tax.
I don't know how it would work. But
it's a silly idea. He's a young kid.
This is from Tony. This is from Tony. Tony says, according to the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, Allen, traffic circles make a 37% reduction in overall collisions, a 75% reduction in injury collisions, a 90% reduction in fatality collisions, and a 40% reduction in pedestrian collisions.
I don't believe it.
It's all true, but you can't put them just everywhere. So that's, you know, not in our historic city. They don't fit.
And I want to know how that study was done.
Well, that pretty much matches when I was describing the roundabout they put up by the thruway in Kingston. There's no doubt that there are fewer serious accidents and fewer accidents in general. You can document that. But as I say, there are a lot of people, particularly those people who come off the thruway and aren't familiar with them, that flaunt the idea of them. So it's just an unpopular thing, but it has worked.
By the way, panel, I know I'm growing more senile by the day, but did I give the Vox Pop number at some point? Because the Vox Pop lines are lighting up, and it's not the call. Vox Pop is at 2. We'll be doing home improvement today. You can talk about any project you want to, but not now. So if you're calling the Vox Pop line, hang up. Otherwise, it's going to ring a long time. This is from Pete. Pete says, I think what's being misinterpreted about boycotting corporations located in Georgia is that these corporations are donating money to politicians that support voter suppression. It's not about the de facto location. It's about who their big money supports. Follow the money. And that's right. From Pete.
Hey, Ray, can
that's
I ask
good,
you a
good
question?
Good point.
What?
Voting rights.
Yeah.
So the Major League Baseball All-Star Game is in Georgia.
Yeah.
Do you think they should move it?
Well, you know, Joe Biden just said he supports doing that. I don't know.
Supports moving it?
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
I just saw it on the crawl on CNN. Hmm. I mean, I generally speaking, it's an exhibition game and fairly meaningless. I don't know how much money they're going to make on it. So I don't know what kind of a actual hard statement that makes, but I guess it's a symbolic one.
I have a related
question.
Yeah,
it's symbolic, and you're going to see a lot of support for it, particularly among the African-American players. But I don't know that it'll happen, but it may well. If there's enough groundswell, they'll move. Baseball will move it.
I have a related question, Ray. Every year, early in the morning, I come in and I look at you and I say, so how are the Mets going to do this year? And every year you say they're going to take it all. Now every year they don't, of course. Some more extra money in there and there. So can I just ask you, what's your predictions for the Mets?
Well, Alan, as you know, you can't make predictions. Nostradamus, I am not. But I will say that the ownership now of the Mets is really going in the right direction. And I'm very, very happy with the direction the team is going. And Let's hope there's a whole season. I mean, at this point, they're putting 10%. Some in Texas, there's 100% of fans are allowed in the stadium. In New York, it's 20%. So at Citi Field, where the Mets play, it's 8,500 people. In Yankee Stadium, it's about 10,000 people. Is that too many? We're in a pandemic. It's still going. New York City is still seeing a significant level of cases. So let's just hope there's a season by October.
I see. But so, in other words, all you had to do is say, same as last year, I predict they'll win everything.
I think they're gonna make the playoffs.
They need bullpen help, Ray.
All right. Well,
see, Ira's an old sports writer, and he knows these things just as you do, Ray. You're both very bright on this subject. I know nothing.
But to your point, Ray, you're going to watch the Yankee game today. There'll be 10,500 people in that ballpark, which sounds like a lot. But when you see the pictures of the park, it'll look like it's empty.
You know,
it's
an improvement, though, right?
Absolutely.
You know, the fake fans, as somebody said on the Major League Baseball Network, you saw a cardboard cutout fan get hit in the head with a home run ball. It was funny once. After that, it's not so funny. And then one of the interesting things I heard from a former ball player on SNY, which is the Mets network down in New York, he was a former catcher, middling catcher, decent player, and he said the thing I missed most last year about with no fans in the stadium was the smell of the stadium, the hot dogs and the popcorn and everything else. And I thought that was a really interesting observation.
He hasn't been to the men's room there lately.
Well, the men's room at Shea, yeah, that's a good point. Thanks for bringing that up.
But you know, one more point: the vaccination program is going to solve most of the remaining problems, at least among the players. They're all eligible now. I suspect that they'll get them as fast as Cuomo's family got theirs, and the fear of players being stricken will be eradicated.
I believe that Roger Goodell, who's the commissioner of football the other day, and we talked about this yesterday on Vox Pop as a,
you did. It's a good show.
Form of magical thinking. He said, I want full stadiums when the NFL kicks off in September. And that's 80,000 people for most of these stadiums. I mean, you going to pull that off?
They got to show their certificate.
I think it's doable.
You really do, Ira.
I think the vaccines are going to make a big difference, and we're talking 6 months or 5 months away. A lot will happen between now and then.
That's a lot of people jammed together. I know it's outside, and people will be wearing masks. But I saw an email to the roundtable the other day that came in and said, "Oh yeah, I was just on a flight to Denver, a red eye flight, packed, not a seat to be had in the place." I mean, is it too early for that sort of thing?
Yes.
Yes.
All right, and then we hear from two people who say yes, so we'll call that a quorum. This is from Christopher. Christopher writes, the worst part of it is, and this is the Georgia law, the worst part of it is that it gives the state legislature the power to usurp the powers of local election boards. If the results go the wrong way, the legislature can find ways to overturn the results. That's fascism, and that's from Christopher.
And Christopher is right.
All right, this one's from Pat. Pat says, corporations' comments about the new laws at this point. So I ask, how much money will these corporations give to the politicians who pass this next election go-round? And we've talked about that. Money talks.
Probably less now that their consciousness appears to be raised.
Maybe. The governor of, we only have a minute here, and I'm sorry to say, but the governor of Georgia said this about Delta. He said, throughout the legislative process, we spoke directly with Delta representatives numerous times. This is Kemp talking. Today's statement stands in stark contrast to our conversations with the company, ignores the content of the new law, and unfortunately continues to spread the same false attacks being repeated by partisan activists. So that's what the governor says about Delta, and the Georgia House, Republicans of the Georgia House, voted to strip Delta of a tax break worth tens of millions of dollars annually. So this fight will go on, and I suspect you guys will be talking about this quite a bit in the future.
Yeah, I guess we will. But I'll tell you one thing. Delta now has public opinion on their side. And, you know, the state of Georgia did this for one reason and one reason only. The fact that Georgia went blue, period. No other reason. And they are just scrambling to do anything to take it back in 2022, you know, as best as they can. So Delta can lose that tax break. But, you know, I would start considering moving services to other states.
You think
let Georgia hurt.
You think we'll see that, Alan?
It's possible. You know, if people get angry, that's what it'll take. You know, there may be a whole reassessment here. There's also a question of when Delta did what it did, and was it too late or too early or too late? Let's put it that way. And maybe there's some hypocrisy here.
I'd rather they stay where they are and use their influence for good.
Yeah, that's a good point.
We had one note about electric vehicles who wrote in, most newer electric vehicles, my Prius, for example, plug into a standard 120-volt outlet. That I did not know.
Nice.
So really, do you need, I think Biden's infrastructure, oh, we're almost out of time, but I think he was talking about hundreds of millions of dollars for electric plug-ins.
Well the big why.
Plug-ins and gas stations.
Yeah, and the big why in Great Barrington has a huge operation. I never see a car there, but electrical operation.
Well, listen, guys, we're going to have to leave it there. And thank you all for being with us on the panel. Teresa Bourgeois, stay safe over there. Do not make any swords over in Cohoes for the time being. Ira Fussfeld, I guess it's about time for that first race over at the OTB.
No, not the first race, but it's almost time to play ball.
Malcolm, yes,
go
it
Mets.
Is. Malcolm Nance, thanks for being here. Good luck with the new book. Alan Shartok, thank you, sir, for whatever it is that I am thanking you for. And yeah, that's the roundtable. There's a lot more to come. Congressional Corner, et cetera, et cetera. Stand by.